This is Tracy Kutchker. I am sitting in front of the Cardiff Miller Art Warehouse in Enderby, BC. It's a beautiful day, and I am joined by internationally recognized sound artists Janet Cardiff and George Burrs Miller. Hello to you.
Hi.
Hi, Tracy.
I'm really happy to have this conversation with you because, of course, I've been in your life for a long time and have learned a lot about your work over the years. But I think in this area, in the shoe shop, there's still a lot of people that have a lot to learn about the incredible sound work that you've been doing over the past few decades. One of the interesting things about being here interviewing the two of you is that being outside of your art warehouse means that we're in a parking lot where people might be coming to visit the gallery, but also taking their floaty items and hitting the river on the Shuswap River nearby. So we're going to have a lot of interesting sounds during our interview.
That's true. And hanging around with us, you become aware of sounds, for sure.
I'll bet. So I am keen to learn more about what brought you both here to the Grindrod Enderby area after living in Berlin and all kinds of places all over the world and experiencing an incredible growth in your artistic practice. How did you end up here?
Well, we've been living in Berlin, as you've mentioned, and we were adopting our daughter and we wanted to have a base in Canada. I'd given up my professorship in Lethbridge, Alberta, so we still had our house there, but we didn't want to go back there. The community's great there, but the weather's really difficult. And I'd spent summers in the Okanagan when I was a teenager, and I just loved it. And George also had like three brothers and his mother in the Okanagan in Vernon and Kelowna. So all we told the realtor was we want to get a place on the river with a big studio and the house we can sort of adapt.
And really just at the beginning, it was just a summer place. We were splitting our time between Berlin and here for the first 5 or 6 years, I guess. We bought in 2004, something like that. And then it just ended up that, well, when our daughter became school age, that we needed a place for her to go to school, and we thought Canada would be more. She preferred Canada, I think. She was very headstrong even at six.
Well, actually, it was more about the German school system. It's almost impossible to get kids out for even a day, like an extra day before Christmas or something like that. And because we travel a lot for our work, we might be doing a site project somewhere and it had to be 2 months in Rome or do, you know, another piece that's a couple of weeks here and there. So we needed to be able to travel with our child. And I have to say the Canadian educational system, especially the Grindrod little elementary school, was like, sure, that'll be great for her. What a great education she'll get. And so we were given a lot of freedom by coming back to Canada, as well as we had family. We had George's mother and his family around. My family is all in Ontario, and I have a very large extended family, and they're all in southwestern Ontario. So we found this place, and it had a really big studio and a house that needed renovating, which we were able to do while we were still in Berlin. And we've just been making works since then, and we use, you know, it as a base.
Can you tell me about how you two started working together? I mean, this is an incredible collaborative team you've built. And I know, Janet, some of your work before George joined that kind of arts practice. So tell us about how you first started collaborating.
Well, we met when we were at art school, but we didn't start collaborating until maybe 10, 15 years after we were married in 83, and then I guess our first collaboration was in 96. But so we were always working on each other's work a lot. I did video installations and Janet would do the camera because a lot of it was me performing on camera, so she would be shooting that. And she started the audio walks. When did you start those?
1991.
And I was the mixer and the editor of the audio walks. But we always talked about work all the time and imagine this, imagine that. And we'd been talking about an installation piece for so long that we'd forgotten whose idea it was. And it became the dark pool. So we decided to do it as a collaboration. And Janet had gotten a show at Western Front Gallery and she asked them if we could do this piece as a collaboration. So that was 96, I think.
95.
95.
Yeah.
So that was our first collaboration, and we found that working together, we made very different work than our solo work. And it was, in a way, very interesting to us. I mean, I think we still, Janet definitely works solo. I don't do as much solo. I'm more writing songs now, but Janet's doing paintings and stuff. But so we still have our solo stuff that we do, but we enjoy working together, and we enjoy that difference that comes out when we collaborate.
Yeah, I think when you trust somebody implicitly, their aesthetic as well as their point of view and their opinion, that I can take him a script that I'm writing for maybe one of the works, and he'll go, okay, well, this segment's pretty interesting, but this is really bad. You know, I think our egos are pretty established in how we work with each other, so we don't get insulted too much when the other one disses it. We're very straightforward with each other, as well as I really think, like, George has an incredible sense of humor, and he's got a different type of intellect than I do, and I like just making things, and I sort of, not very concentrated approach. I might work on 5 pieces or 6 pieces at a time, and I go into the studio and I think I'm going to be doing this, and then I see a table and I get sidetracked, so I'm working on that, and then I go over and, oh yeah, well, this was kind of interesting, I'll work on that. But George is more, he has a much more sort of a, how would you say, focused way of working, as well as he's more of a perfectionist than me. So it actually really, really works out well, our combination, as well as we're both formally trained, like we went through traditional art school, and so that we both have a good sense of form and color and space. And sound is the same as drawing. You know, you need your textures, you need your difference in complexity. And when you're making music, it's the same sort of thing. You know, you just can't have all the same kind of beat. Like, it's boring. You have to have texture. You have to have complexity. It's like a drawing line. You want a line that has, you know, some flow to it, but you might add some dark and light and all that. So I think it's important to have that type of approach.
Between the two of you, you're pretty versed in a lot of different media types. Putting together sound with also sculpture and, like, just that experience that you're creating for people, they're entering a room and they're having an experience, requires a lot of different media types. You know, it's really helpful to be really good at sculpting and painting.
Yeah. And that's true. And like escape room, which we did during COVID time, it's model making, a lot of it. And George was drawing up buildings on SketchUp and printing them out with a laser cutter, and I'd be painting them, or else I'd be working on the mud castle, you know, like just slopping up, experimenting with how you put sand with plaster and color and making all this stuff. And then we had other people working with us. We're all like this little workshop of people making tiny little furniture and miniature. We like the miniature and we like models. We've done a lot of that because I think it allows the viewer's imagination to enter into a space and imagine what it's like to be in one of these buildings. Because of that sort of thing too, I think a lot of our work is quite accessible to not only to the uneducated art viewer, but to kids as well as older people. Yeah, and I think we always want to tell some kind of story. So we're kind of filmmakers, only we use a lot of different media.
And integrating the viewer into your story. Mm-hmm. That's a very important perspective to add, because people do feel connected to your works that way.
Yeah, I think we try to work on kind of universal sensibilities.
Well, we often add just enough information so that people can build their own story out of it. I think we both grew up watching a lot of experimental films from Europe, and how a story doesn't have to be completely coherent. It's almost more interesting when, in fact, I used to like watching TV at night, when you come into the middle of the movie and you kind of have to figure out, well, who's the bad guy and who's the good guy and whatever, and all, and try and figure out all the dynamics of the different characters instead of being given everything right from the get-go, as Hollywood movies usually do. They basically spell it out for you. If you didn't get it, they spell it out for you later again, and they'll have a flashback as well to explain it even more. So we like the idea of, like, you just give people a little bit of information, and people want a story so badly that they build the story immediately. Mm-hmm. So we give a few snippets of something, and use the Hitchcock MacGuffin sometimes just to add a little bit of storyline. And
I think also the technique, though, because we use a lot of interaction so that people's movements walking through a space will cause sound to come out.
Right.
And that leads to the whole thing with our different talents. Like, I remember one of my first audio installations, it was done in 1992, I think. And I said to George, we found this old table in our basement. I says, how do you make it circuit, whatever, that when you pass your hands over the table, sound comes out, says speakers around the room. And he goes, whoa, I had to figure that out. He's a problem solver. And so now with some of our contemporary works where we have like 98 soundtracks, or we have an organ that plays surround sound, you know, like all the keys of an organ, and each one is a different surround sound thing. You know, all that behind the scenes is a lot of coding, a lot of computer control systems, and just really, really complex stuff. And that's one of George's fortes, so. I don't even know how to turn on our works. We like to make. That's one reason I also like plein air painting, because you're out enjoying the river, you're out enjoying the forest, whatever. But you're not just sitting there staring at something, you're actually working. So I have a really strong work ethic, so that I feel like I'm doing something, right? It's like when you go on holidays and you take pictures, you feel like you're doing something.
Yeah. So you're still adding to your artistic practice when you are doing things like that, when you're having experiences. And like you said earlier, you become very aware of every sound when you're a sound artist. So living in a quieter place like Enderby, I mean, this must have changed your experiences and how you bring those experiences into your artwork compared to, say, Berlin.
Yeah, except we both grew up in small towns, so I think we already had incorporated that kind of rural nature into our work. But being back certainly has made it. It was a nice dichotomy when we were living in Berlin and in Grindrod, and we made a couple of pieces that are kind of...
They're very European, but at the same time very North American.
They're very between two cultures. Mm-hmm. And that was a kind of a really nice time when we were doing that. We still go back to Berlin a lot, so we still get that. But we love being out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Being on the river. And
like you said, we grew up in rural areas. George's dad was a vet, so he'd go out to the farms a lot. But I grew up on a working farm. And, I just remember the nicest times was just out wandering with my dog. And in ways, I think the audio walks came out of that, trying to get that sense of the childhood freedom back and just wandering and listening to everything, watching the butterflies. And so it's, I think it's a big part of it. But at the same time, Berlin is actually a very quiet city, surprisingly, where we were living and everything, because every big apartment complex has this big green yard. They call it the Hof, and there's usually a bunch of trees in it, and everybody's sort of terrace faces that, and it's quite quiet, like nothing like London. And there's a lot of bicycle movement, so there's not as many cars as Toronto or a lot of the big cities. So I think that's how we like, one reason we also like Berlin, because it's a very quiet city. Sometimes you think the bomb's gone off, like Sunday morning, like, where are all the people?
And they were out partying till 4 in the morning. That's why no one's up on a Sunday morning.
So now here we are at the Cardiff Miller Art Warehouse, a pretty significant contemporary art gallery in the North Okanagan, or South Shuswap, whatever we are here. What made you decide to open this gallery here? This is a really big ordeal.
It's an ordeal, actually.
it's an ordeal.
But it's also kind of fun having your own little museum.
I'd say this is not a little museum.
Yeah, no, it's 20,000 square feet and almost 20-foot ceilings, and we've got 10 different installations up now. For, about a decade, I think we've always sort of had the idea that it'd be really nice to be able to see our work up somewhere and have kind of like a institute for our work, because a lot of times museums buy it and it goes into their collections, goes into their storage, and gets shown maybe once every 5 years. And we have works that go to a big show and then they come back and they're stuck in their crates. So we never really get to experience or share. I happened to be on a camping trip and somebody was talking about this building's up for sale. And I'm going, wow, it's an old furniture warehouse and it's just perfect. We sort of basically took a lot of the inside structure and offices and stuff out and we just basically left it open. It's an incredible space. And we had to change the way we show our work. We didn't want to build a lot of walls for one reason, because then it would hide the space. But also, if you build a lot of sound walls and contained rooms so that the pieces don't influence each other or interfere with each other sound-wise, then it's expensive. It was going to cost $500,000 to build rooms to contain everything. So we just said, okay, well, let's work it by sequencing it. And so George figured out the system that you can have one come on, and then another one comes on, and then another one comes on, and then they sequence again. So then you get to start at the beginning of one, and then it stops, and then you go on to the next one, and then you can sit down. Say the Murder of Crows is 30 minutes long. You can experience that. And then you go to the second museum gallery. We have two buildings, and so the second one has also got three pieces that sequence.
So we'd been thinking for years about having a space of our own. I mean, we always imagined it, and that's why we kept so many of our works. A lot of these are additioned works, so there's other copies of them in the world. Some of them are owned by major museums. Some of them are owned by collectors. But we always tried to keep one. Even Marionette Maker, which is a super complicated work, we did two of them so that we would have one.
And it's in a collection in the U.S.
Yeah, so we've been thinking for years that we would eventually get a space. And so when we found this building, we were ecstatic. We'd been looking maybe for 5 years for a building.
Yeah, we
looked on the coast at a number of buildings, and there was always a problem. The ceilings weren't high enough, or it wasn't quite big enough, or it was too expensive. And then this building was, I mean, relatively expensive as well, but it's on leased land, which is different. And it was the perfect building. It's like just a big, two big boxes, and totally ready for the type of work that we do.
And it's a big undertaking, because basically, because we just show our own work, we can't get any grants or anything, so it comes out of our pocket, basically. So it's a labor of love. And we've been incredibly supported by the arts community in the area, and we get visitors from all over the world now this year. It's our third year running. And so word is getting out, which is great. We find a lot of people are thanking us, says, thank you for having this in Enderby. You know, we didn't expect to see something like this in Enderby.
Yeah, it's definitely the highlight of a lot of camping trips.
And so part of it also for us is that, I mean, we grew up in small towns. Each of us had different cultural experiences in those small towns of things that, you know, special things, that magical things that came to our communities and kind of changed our lives. And so we felt it would be a nice thing to, you know, have here so that kids can see that art doesn't have to be one thing. It can be something else. I mean, we love painting, we love traditional sculpture, we love traditional painting, but we also think it's nice for this community to be able to see that there's other stuff out there and maybe get interested in it. And also we like the idea of the European model, where in Europe there's always a kind of this different thing where families will go to a museum on a Sunday, and we would love if we could kind of get that to happen here, you know, so that give people something else to do rather than surfing the internet.
Yeah. We've been building educational tours, so we've got the local universities coming in, some of the local high schools, and we're really trying to build that. We've started doing some workshops with people for like craft workshops, and so we're developing workshops that kids can come in and they can make little figures, and they take them back to the classroom, and the teachers can go into project on narrative and make a diorama to go with it and all sorts of things. So
even
education
art
is a really big thing that we're trying to focus on right now. But it's bit by bit, you know, because we're really busy still producing work as well as exhibiting work. We have several shows coming up. So we can only spend so much time here. And that's why we have a manager for the building, and she's been sort of doing outreach with tourism and different things. But I think word of mouth is actually the thing that's...
Word of mouth is really what works, ultimately. At the end of the day, that's your best marketing tool.
Yeah.
And people do have wonderful experiences here. So, I mean, that's just great.
That's great.
I do have a
question. I hope the listeners that are listening right now will get intrigued enough to go, oh, I want something different, you know, or, you know, I'm curious about robotic marionettes that move, a little tiny singer that moves her mouth when she's singing an aria opera, or a little piano player who's playing a piano and his fingers move or his hands move.
And so, how many people think that there's a really excellent performance artist laying there sleeping in Marionette Maker?
Yeah, there's that's always intriguing for people, seeing this full-scale silicon replica of me done by a film industry company in Vancouver who basically does that, creates life-like replicas of actors. So she's sleeping in this caravan, and it's like these little characters around her, like Gulliver's Travels, are all over her, but in the room dancing and playing like it's in her dreams. So there's always some sort of story behind it that could be about a sort of dream landscape. And the marionette maker, another little character in there who's designing at his table, trying to figure out how to make more marionettes to amuse the sleeping woman.
Lovely. It's a great piece.
And she'll never age. She's like,
yeah.
It was like over 10 years ago she was done now, so it's great.
You're like a saint. How do you decide which works you're going to show here out of the dozens and dozens that must be on tour and in exhibitions all over the world? How do you curate the ones that you can fit into this building?
Whatever's available. Now, we're always thinking, like, we started with four pieces when we opened 2 years ago. They were the ones that hadn't been shown for a while because they needed a bigger space, and so that was what was great about this space, finding it, that we could show. I mean, Murder of Crows shows probably once every couple of years in other places, but it's just nice to have it in a big building here permanently. Also, there's a few problem pieces that are harder to show and that don't get shown as often, and so we have them up.
The show in Portugal, where we're now, it's just come down, so we're waiting for the crates to come back in container ships over the sea.
We'd use it as our storage, so it's the warehouse, so everything goes in here, so we have to fit it in somehow.
That's why we called it Cardiff Miller Art Warehouse, because at various times it's got a lot of crates in it.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it curating, I'd call it kind of managing. And we do think about, like, okay, will this piece go into this? But it's been surprising, too, because some pieces we'd never shown together, like we're showing Storm Room right now, sequenced with 40-part motet. I didn't know that they would go together so well. Like, one is just a storm and water hitting the windows in this room, and the other is a 40-speaker piece with each speaker a singer singing Thomas Tallis's Spaminalium in the round, and so one plays, then the other plays, and actually now we have a third piece in that sequence. But when we first set up the Storm Room motet sequence, I was wondering, like, one's completely a sound piece and one is completely a music piece, how they would go together, and they seem to work remarkably well together, actually. I really enjoy it. So it's something we'd never done, was this type of sequencing jam. It was already talking about that. And now Carney in there actually kind of works as well. It's a whole other different kind of piece.
Mm-hmm. I think we're looking at different types of works that can go together.
And right now we want to put opera for a small room into that sequence. But we'll see if...
It also cost us a bunch to have it installed, because we have a system that comes in from Calgary or from Berlin to install some of the work.
That's one of my favorite pieces of
really?
Opera for a small
it's
room.
It's my favorite, I think,
yeah.
actually.
So. Yeah. I love it.
We're going to have a big show coming up in Italy.
In a couple of years.
And it's a space that is actually two or three times the size of this space, but one whole space. And it has, I don't know, 50-foot ceilings or something. It's an old hall.
Airplane hangar, I think.
Yeah. But anyway, so they don't want to build any walls. We want to do a bit more experimenting with sequencing and see how many pieces we can actually sequence and how it will work or not.
Great, so this is not just a warehouse, it's a studio.
Yeah, sort of. We're working on a big piece in our studio in Grindrod right now, and who knows, we might have to move it and try it out too, see how it works in
this
space.
True, yeah.
Yeah. Well, if I just mention about the 40-part motet, it's a piece that was done in 2000. Like George said, it's like a virtual choir. There's 40 different speakers in an oval, and We recorded 16th century piece of music by Thomas Tallis, a famous British composer, and one of his most amazing pieces. It's 40 different harmonies. And so when we first heard this piece on stereo, we wanted to hear it in 40 different speakers. So we went through the whole process of recording a whole choir, all individually, and then going to individual speakers. Some of the people we know, it's their favorite piece, but it's a piece that anybody can access. Like people who are have ever sung in a choir too really, really like it, because you can walk around the speakers and listen, you know, inches away from this great tenor from London who's singing this element. But it's a real complex piece of music, a 12-minute long piece of music. So like, I think a lot of her work has that type of accessibility, you know, that you don't have to have an art training, you don't have to know anything about philosophy or science or whatever to enjoy the work. The sound waves hit your body, and it's an emotional piece of music. It's a brilliant piece of music, so you can just
enjoy. I think a lot of our work, though, it's accessible, but I think you have to have an open mind as well.
Yeah.
You have to have an openness and a curiosity.
Curiosity is good.
To engage something that you might never have engaged with before. I mean, I view it as accessible, but I don't know what the average viewer would. I mean, every now and then we have people come in and they're terrified of some of
it. Yeah, they feel like, I don't know what this is.
It takes them out of their frame of reference, and some people get very uncomfortable with that.
But generally, I'd say 98% of the audience we get in here are just beaming, and it makes us feel like, okay, we're doing the right thing. We're helping the cultural environment in our local area, and we're adding to people's thoughts.
And you're helping young people understand that there's a place for them in the arts. It doesn't have to be, you know, in a certain kind of box.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Are there any little secrets or any little things that the average visitor wouldn't notice when they visit Cardiff Miller Art Warehouse that you would share with us?
Easter eggs. Well, Marionette Maker has a number of Easter eggs, but the one that I like the most is when you have to get down on your hands and knees and look in the old compartment of the trailer, and inside of there is a full scene of a lake and mountains and a miniature little trailer on the edge of the lake in a kind of a moonlit scene, and it's the trailer that it's inside of, so it's like this.
It's like a Russian doll kind
of
thing.
Yeah, inside of the trailer. Another Easter egg in Marionette Maker is the night sky. If you look through the upper windows where a bunk would be, there's kind of this weird, distorted, starry night sky that seems to be off in the distance. It's an illusion that's created using mirrors and LEDs.
Well, let's go inside and have a little walkabout, and maybe you can share some other little details about the works in there.
Okie dokie.
Sounds good.